no helicopters have been procured for me to go to golf course. Thank you.
I've never said he wasn't a great politician. I'm just saying he's a
officer. It's supposed to be an interview.
How'd you play out there today?
Well, I found the conditions challenging, mostly because there's no grass on the golf course, but there never has been.
I'm thinking about the swag bag, and I have high hopes for the swag bag.
When you got three crevices on the green, your course is trash.
What is going on, folks? Welcome back to the Bellway Golfer Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Dixon. This is episode 76. On today's show, we've got Jim Estes. Jim is an interesting gentleman that I've been wanting to have on for quite some time. He's a DC area native, but he is not only a former card-holding member of the PGA Tour, and one of the few, I think, in this region that actively coaches today that has that kind of experience. He's played in five majors, as we talk about in our conversation. But he was also the co-founder of the Salute Military Golf Association, which was one of the first nonprofits to get injured combat veterans access to the game of golf. They've been around for quite some time, founded right here in Montgomery County. So, it being Veterans Day weekend, I thought it would be got a little bit late getting this the podcast out. Veterans Day was just this past Saturday, but in honor of that, I thought it would be a good time to talk about the SMGA, the Salute Military Golf Association, and have Jim on. Jim also was a longtime coach of the Good Counsel High School golf program, and spent 20 years teaching at Olney Golf Park. Just last year made the switch and is now an instructor at Blue Mash and Olney. So go find him at jimestesgolf.com and you can get lessons from him out of Blue Mash. But another thing we talked about in our conversation, this was towards the end, but during his time, both as a teacher at Olney Golf Park and as the Good Counsel High School coach, he taught a young student, Madison Smith, who tragically passed away just a few weeks ago, who was an all-met golfer in the Good Counsel program, who her first coach prior to high school was Jim Estes. And if you're following Bellway Golfer on Instagram, we did post a little video, kind of just a tiny little tribute video at Manor Country Club in honor of Madison Smith, where she was a member. If you want to learn more about her story, Washington Post has a couple articles. You can Google that, Madison Smith golf in under the Washington Post. But towards the end of our conversation, Jim has an opportunity to talk about her and what it was like coaching her and her as a golfer and a person. So I was glad to have the opportunity to mention her on the podcast. Speaking of Instagram, if you're just listening to this podcast and you want to follow more of what we're doing here at Bellway Golfer, certainly that's the primary social media. You can find Bellway Golfer is on Instagram, but also we've got a monthly newsletter. This month I'm putting out a new guide as the winter months are coming up and indoor golf has kind of exploded around this area. I've done a few podcasts with operators of indoor golf establishments in the area in the past, but we're putting out a whole guide. This will be part of our newsletter and on our website of, you know, the differences in all the different indoor golf simulator businesses, places that you can play indoor golf around the Washington, D.C. area. So stay tuned to that and sign up for our newsletter at beltwaygolfer.com. Before we get to the conversation with Jim, this podcast, it continues to be sponsored by Union Green. Union Green, golf social, play local is their motto. But Union Green has sponsored this podcast and Bellway Golfer for a little while now. And they're a great sponsor. They're a great partner. And they've got two different golf balls that are just the right price point, especially for the amateur golfer. They've got their Pin Drop, which is their three-piece, and their T-Bird, which is their two-piece designed for distance, but it's, you know, it's $20 a dozen. And right now they've got a special on their website. Buy any two pieces of apparel, get a free dozen T T-Bird golf balls. I'm rocking one of the Union Green hats right now, kind of a classic dad cap with a flag. They've got some cool stuff on there. The Pour Caddy, if you like to partake in adult beverages on the golf course, check out their Pour Caddy on their website. It's a way to pour your beverages. They've got built-in little shot glasses they bring at you on the course. It's kind of a pretty cool item for those that like to partake. But go to uniongreen.com. You can enter discount code BeltwayGolfer20. Get 20% off anything you purchase there at uniongreen.com. And by supporting Union Green, you're supporting what we're doing here at Beltway Golfer and this podcast. So appreciate Union Green as a sponsor. Again, uniongreen.com. That is it. Let's get to episode 76 of the podcast. One note. Before we started recording, we were kind of already into our conversation. There's not really an introduction. We just kind of jump right into talking about Jim's career as Jim is kind of talking about his background and his career in college golf and becoming a touring professional. Here it is, episode 76 with Jim Estes. Enjoy.
I started there, you know, I turned pro and was not a really good golfer in college. It was difficult for me academically to put together. I had a full scholarship to Tennessee, and Jim Gallagher and four seniors were on the team when I was a freshman. And I came in, I was pretty highly ranked junior. I made it to the semifinals of the U.S. Junior. But I had a difficult time there because I had four seniors to deal with. And I had put a lot of pressure on myself to play well. I averaged like 74, 4.5, 75.
But going further back, like where?
Yeah,
where did
no,
you...
I got a scholarship. I went to school at Perry High School, which was a public school, and it shut down in '84.
Okay.
But I runner up in state high school, and I did reasonably. I won Player of the Year for the area so I got to Tennessee, and I did pretty well. We had Jim Gallagher, who ended up obviously being a Ryder Cup player and won five times on the tour. And we had another guy who was an All-American. There was four seniors, and then they were expecting me to come in there, and it was difficult because it was a transition, obviously, being a freshman, going to school, trying to, you know, delegate time to playing the game and then making sure that I did work, you know, well enough in school. So my freshman year, I averaged, you know, 74 and a half, 75. And we got we got a bid to the NCAA. We did. But I think those guys expected more from me. So I think it was probably because I put more pressure on myself. But they were going to build a range. Gibby Gilbert and Gibby's dad and then some other people within the family of golf got together and put a proposal together to build a golf range, and they did, but it was a long time after. And so one of the contentions was, how are you going to get golf, top golfers without a driving range? And it took them forever to build it. So I ended up transferring.
That was one of the reasons, was because that project was taking so long.
Yeah. And we were picking up our own range balls. This is a long time ago, you know.
Sure.
Shagging our own golf balls. So in a park. And so it was a little bit of a, it wasn't the best. Especially
in the 80s, that's still, I mean, that's an SEC school. It was a program without a range where you're picking up your own range balls in the park. Was that rare? Or was that somewhat commonplace?
I think that we were probably, I think we were among the minority, let's just say. I was a good experience playing there because I got to play with, you know, good players, and we had a good team. And we were in the top three or four in SEC, and we got a bid to the NCAA tournament my freshman year, despite the fact I struggled. Playing because of, like I said, I think some of the guys were, I was sort of, you know, I was probably pretty sensitive, and some of them were giving me a little bit of grief. Played better my sophomore year, and then they had the problem with, because they promised us when I came in as a freshman, I took the scholarship, but they had promised that the range would be built. But anyway, So fast forward, I go to Maryland and I played there. Fred Funk was the coach there for a year. So I ended up working with Fred. That was interesting.
You're saying he was there because that was just your senior year? That's why he was only there for a year? Or that was the end of his coaching?
Well, back then, you lost a year redshirting.
Right.
But Fred, he was – I mean, he really worked hard on his golf game. I don't know that his coaching skills were – his priority at that point, but we used to give him a hard time about it. And one day I got a little upset and we had sort of a confrontation and I said, you spend more time with your golf, you hit more balls and practice harder for your own self than you do. I think your skill set's probably to play the game. I'm not sure that you should be coaching. And he got all upset about that. You're out of line. You shouldn't talk to me like that. But that's funny because I always, whenever I see him, I said, where's the check? I expect you, I should be having a little retainer check for, pushing you out to go out and play the game for a living. And he quit. I mean, he actually, after that, he went out and I got paired with him in the 1989 tour school at Jones Creek. And we both made it through, but It was hilarious because,
aside from that one confrontation as a coach and a player, did you guys have a good relationship beyond that?
Yeah. I mean, there was definitely, we got into a pretty heated argument. I mean, I won't lie. I mean, but other than that, we laugh about it now. And,
when he was that year that he was coaching your senior year, was he really, where was he with his game at that point? Like, was he playing in PGA? And what was he doing?
Well, he'd done really well in the section tournaments. So he had just needed to move to the next level. And he'd started practicing really hard. And, back then, distance wasn't his priority as much as it is now. I mean, and so he was really perfect for the time, for the clubs that were being used and the time period, he could play. He could hit it far enough. But, accuracy was obviously a premium. And obviously had an incredible career. And once I moved on from Maryland, I didn't really do very well when I transferred because I lost credit and I was worried about graduating and everything. And my golf game sort of took a backseat to me just trying to get out of school because at that point, I'd lost almost a year of credit, and not that I didn't play. I mean, I played okay, but not to the level that I wanted to play. So that's why I had this desire to go out and try to play a little bit because I really had not really – I didn't think exercised my full potential, playing in college. And that's when I went to South Africa in 1988 and 1989. Played in Asia a little bit, and then made the Hogan Tour back then. Now they call it the Corn Ferry, and then played a little bit on that. And
can I ask what is that experience like before you even get to the Hogan Tour? Going to South Africa, playing the Asian Tour. This is in the late '80s, right? I mean,
1989. That was pretty for me. That was quite exciting. Getting to travel to Cape Town and to, Johannesburg, it was a 3-month tour and you paid your money and you got a hotel room and there was qualifications on Mondays, just like they did tour back in the tour. They still do have Monday qualifying. And I got a really good experience. I didn't do particularly well. I made a couple of cuts out of about 7 or 8 tournaments. But it was really just experience for me. I mean, going out and, David Faraday was playing at that time. And there were all kinds of guys that, older guys that, may not even heard of. But, Sam Torrance played.
Were there many other American golfers with him?
Yeah, I mean, some of the American golfers that played, there was probably 10 or 11 guys. And, the guys that went down there, some of them played really well down there and they would stay down there So it was usually January, February down there. And, you know, the seasons are switched, right? So winter is summer down there. So there are guys that played that would stay down there past the time so that they could play more tournaments. I just stayed there for the 7 or 8 tournaments that were a part of the Sunshine Tour at that time. And
was there much money in it, even for the guys that were doing really well on those tours, like South Africa and Asia? Was there money in it back then?
Yeah, if you won, you could make $100, which was pretty good back then. If you made the cut, you know, you could make your, you know, $4,000, $3,000, $4,000. It was okay. It was good money because the European tour at that time wasn't a part of South African tour, and now they're all together. But they had good sponsorship from for the tour, and a lot of the European players, like they do today, a lot of the European players were playing down there in South Africa. Obviously, couldn't be because of the seasonal changes. I mean, it's south of Spain you could probably play, but they didn't have an extensive European tour schedule back then as they do now. But yeah, there were guys like Fran Quinn. Fran Quinn's playing on the Champions Tour. He played down there, and I'm trying to think of some guys that have gone on to be successful. Colin Montgomerie played. Gurney Ells played, obviously. And some of the, you know, older South African golfers, you wouldn't know who they are, but a guy like Hugh Byaki, who played some on the Champions Tour. But it was a good, like I said, it was a good experience. And I certainly going to Swaziland and these different countries, like, it was wild, man. I mean, there was, you know, the tribes of, back then it was apartheid too. So, you know, it was funny, the black tribes, like the Swana and Zulu tribes, they would fight among themselves, but the Dutch colony ran, the government was run by the Dutch. They were, you know, they were prejudiced people. And so they had white and black bathrooms, and it was like the 60s, you know, so it was pretty wild. Mm. But Mandela, you know, they changed all that. So that's good.
Sure. Were people coming out to your tournaments, or are you playing to kind of an
empty? Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, okay. They were good. I mean, golf was a big sport, is a big sport still. And yeah, they had people coming out. And like I said, not only was it well represented from a financial standpoint, there was quite a, you know, because Gary Player was still playing at that time. And
okay.
He would play in the South African Open. And he, you know, so there was still, you know, South Africa. It's Bermuda grass primarily you're playing on, and some of the golf courses were really difficult, so it was a good experience. And then so I did that, and then I came back after that. I qualified for the Hogan Tour, but I didn't get my tour card. So it's like nowadays in that if you go to qualifying school back then, you would, if you missed the regular tour, they had two separate qualifiers. So you could go to the Hogan Tour qualifier if you missed the regular tour qualifier.
Got it.
And so that's how I got to play with John Daly. You know, that's when he sort of, he was down in South Africa too. The incident, I forgot to. And sure.
So were you going to the qualifying school for the PGA Tour this time, trying to qualify as well?
Yeah, I went. Yeah, I think I went. I don't remember. I couldn't tell you how many times, but it was probably 10.
Okay.
I get to the finals or the second stage. The first time I went, I think I missed in the first stage, but after that, I made it pretty far. I was good at. I would pick the right course for my game, and it was usually a course where there was long, and you know. The weather might not be so good, and if you shot 3 or 4 under par for the week, you would get it. You would get your you would advance, and so that's what I did. I steered clear of some of those Florida golf courses where you could it's risk reward, right? I mean, you tight, you got water on both sides, and the water in front of the green. Those kind of courses, I stick to like parkland courses where it was long and tight, and you know, par was a good score.
Sure. So how long into your career on the Hogan Tour, how many years were you on that tour before you got your win?
No, it's funny. I quit playing after 1990. I gave it a few years because I was basically sponsoring myself. And I had a little bit of sponsor money, but not a ton. In 1991, I got a job as an assistant pro in Baltimore, and then played really well in the section stuff. And the course was called Bonnie View Country Club, and they don't even, it's not even, doesn't even exist now. But then I stayed there a year, and I met in 1990. I went to the U.S. Open, and I met my first wife, and we actually got married in 1992. But and then I ended up moving to Chicago from Baltimore in 1991. I was living here in Maryland and working in Baltimore. And 1990, I met her, and we corresponded back and forth, and had sort of a long distance thing going for a while. And then I married her in 1990. The U.S. Open at Medina was my first major, and man, I played really well. I missed a cut by one stroke, but I led the team, and for 36 holes, I hit them as more greens than anybody in the field. I just didn't putt well. I was putting, you know, I had, I think, 9 or 10 putts inside of 10 feet, and didn't make any. And it was, you know, I got frustrated. But it was a great experience.
How did you qualify for the 90 Open? Do you remember?
Yeah, I mean, I made it over at Woodmont, you know, so I think I shot 600.
Oh, so you went through qualifying. Okay.
Yeah. Played with Tommy Armour. Golly, I might have been Randall Chambly or Larry Mize. When I was in a, I don't know this, there's so many of them run together, but yeah, I mean, back then, Woodmont was the course you went to because the tour site that week, they always had a tour event that either followed or you'd play that Monday qualifier. Actually, you'd play the Monday qualifier after the tour event. So that's why there was always more spots there than anywhere. And so I got through there 4 times, and I played 90, 96, 97, and I played in 98. So, yeah, I mean, it was a good experience too. That course suited me, and the opens I played in, like 90, I played really well, and I played well at Congressional in 97 and Shinnecock Hills, what a golf course. That was the one the Corey Pavin won. That might have been the hardest course I'd ever played up to that point.
Really?
Just because it was windy, there was a lot of hills.
Sure. And
there was a lot of runoff on the fairways. And they were sort of crowned fairways and deep bunkers and very firm, but it was good. But so, yeah, I started working. It's a weird story about the Nike Tour because I was working, you know, from 91 on, I was a club pro, and I still wanted to play. I still had a desire. I thought I could play well enough to maybe someday get a chance for a tour card. So while I was working as an assistant pro, I worked on my game pretty hard, and I was teaching a lot. But yeah, March, you know, I got 2 small kids, and I went out to Moreno Valley Ranch. It's a golf course. It's a Pete Dye golf course. So it's, you know, Pete Dye's risk reward. And I shot 468s and I won. And, you know, I'm thinking now it's March. I got a chance to, if I quit, I should just go. And I got a guy sponsoring from the club, said, hey, I'll give you sponsor money so that you can live comfortably for you and your family and go out and try to make it. So I'm 34 years old. I would never recommend anyone doing it but it was a dream I had. And it was kind of a fluke. So I did. I went out and I played for 96, 97, 98, 99, 2000. So I played for 5 straight years, and I had my PGA Tour card in 98, and I played well enough, you know, on the Nike Tour at that time to do okay, enough to pay the sponsor money back and have profit. So I did okay. But after 2000, when I lost my card in 98, I only made 7 cuts on the PGA Tour
So you had the card for, you had your card for 1 year, one season.
Yeah, I only made 7 cuts, and I enjoyed it, but it was just whenever I got in contention, it was always one round where I would shoot 72 or 3, and I'd be, you know, 20th instead of 8th, and it made a big difference money-wise. I think I finished like 170th or something like that on the money list. So
do you remember what that, I'm curious about that. Do you remember what that deal looked like from your sponsor? Like he loans you as much money as you need.
What's so funny about that? I was the first ever guy to be signed by Tour Edge, and now Tour Edge, Dave Glod, got all of these guys on this Champions Tour, and Bernhard Langer and everything. But I was the first guy they signed in 1990, and they gave me a nice deal. And back then, if you played the ball, the shoe, and the glove. For Titleist, they gave you, I don't remember it, you know, the driver was worth $1,000 a week. And you know, if you played the driver, you know, you could make money. Certainly enough to, now the contracts are way different. I mean, sure. If you get your card now, it's worth, golly, I don't know, maybe $500,000 now. I don't know. Back then when I played, it was, you know, you could pay, you could get close to $100,000 for your tour card. If you signed up with a company and, you know, you held their, the contract would be ball, shoe, glove, and then you'd have your clubs, and sometimes you'd have an apparel contract.
But before that, and maybe I was misunderstood, you had a private sponsor that kind of got you on your feet that you had to pay back?
Yeah, I had a guy that was he worked at the Mercantile Exchange. His name was Jim Yanger, and he was a wealthy guy, and he had figured out how to, a mathematical formula for him, a trading formula that gave him the opportunity to provide a sponsorship for me. And all he did was just provide the expenses. And then he didn't ask for anything, but he wanted to get, you know, whatever I made, he wanted to recoup his whatever the, whatever he gave me. And I think it was around 65 or 70,000 or something like that back then. And that worked out fine. I didn't have any problems. When I started, I forget how I met Tim Landry's, but I think Tim was playing in a pro-am or something. I met him at maybe I was doing an outing or something. I think it was an outing. I met him, and I told him that, you know, I just went to tour school my last time. I've got status on the Nike tour, but I think I'm going to try to work in the golf industry at some point again. And that's when he offered me a job at Only Golf Park. So I started there in 2001.
Was there a time in there? I mean, you had your card for one full year. You lost your card. I imagine when you're, you know, the trying to be a professional golfer or being a professional golfer is just, it's such a unique path that there's this grind, and you're never like, was there a time where you're just like, okay, I'm done. And I'm going to do this. Are you still constant? I imagine you're constantly always like, well, I can still play. I can still try to qualify for this. I can, you know, you never really fully retire, do you?
Well, if you do it long enough, you get to the point where it's not, because, you know, if I had to recommend, and this is what I do when I coach guys on scoring and how to manage their time, I tell them that you have to be prepared to balance your time, but you also have to be, you can't have any major commitments. I mean, if you have a wife, that's fine. But if you've got a wife and kids and you're trying to do it, you're going to have a sponsor that's willing to, you know, provide not only financial, but the financial's the one thing, but then you've got to have someone that's going to support you emotionally. Can't be someone that's going to be calling you up every week saying, you know, how come you didn't play well, or, you know, what's going on. And that sponsor ends up thinking he's your coach, you know? And so what I would say is, if you're trying to play in this day and time, you should definitely be single. And, you know, Steve Bosdosh is a friend, and his son's trying to play, and he's going to the second stage, and he's in a perfect place where he can make some money on his own, doesn't feel the pressure of having to pay a sponsor. And he's basically, because he's working, he can foot his own bill. And I think that's kind of a good way to do it.
Sure.
because he's not, he's, there's no pressure. If he makes it, fine. If he doesn't, he's still got a job and he's still okay. And he's not committed, you know, to anyone. So,
but when you started at the only golf park, was that kind of for you like, okay, I'm going to commit to coaching and teaching and
I was lucky because Tim put me on like a retainer until I started to get some enough business where I didn't need it, but I was an employee on a retainer and, it was a nice place to start because they had a nice practice area and, you know, it was covered and heated. So you could teach pretty much, if you wanted, you could teach all year round. So I sort of kind of, think that it's still a pretty good spot to do that.
So at what can we talk about the Salute Military Golf Association and at what point during your time at Only Golf Park or what was the, how did it come about? How did the idea come about to get this started?
Wow. I mean, you know, I started, in 2005 and six, I would, there was a guy named Billy Bartlett and he was a helicopter gunner pilot in Vietnam. And he had a friend named Hal Koster who had a restaurant. And those guys were trying to help these guys that were getting injured. And back then, Operation Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom, Anbar Province, and there were places that people were really getting hurt. And so the injuries were quite severe. You know, you'd have bilateral amputations, and you'd have sometimes triple amputations, and you'd have brain injuries. But he asked me one day if I would come down and visit some of the guys and talk about the possibility of bringing them outside to the golf course or the driving range. And so we did. And I was reluctant because I wasn't sure if I could teach them, especially, but most of those guys were in great shape. And so even though they might've had a disability, they could really swing the club and had potential. So it was cool because the rehab process really helped the golf. They were doing a lot of stuff that you would do for golf fitness while they were at the hospital. So I brought them out and we started out with like 10 guys and we did weekly clinics and I got to the point where they called it the Warrior Transition Unit. They gave us the opportunity to teach these guys and we got, it took a little bit of time. I actually partnered with DAV and they took the money. I started a Salute Servicemen Day and we raised money that one day we raised like $35,000 and then that money was contributed to DAV. They put it into their bank account and they managed the funds and we used the funds for golf and we used the funds for coaching and then some of the guys got some clubs. So I started to formulate this process of, okay, we'll have a graduation. We'll have a clinic series. We'll have, you know, some food. We'll give them the whole experience that if you were going to go and play golf for the day, that's what you would do. You would hang out with your buddies and you would play golf and you would have lunch. But the thing that made it unique was these people were able to form bonds with each other through the game of golf. So there was a rehabilitation process going on that they didn't even realize by learning the game. And so I didn't have to do anything other than just put these folks together. And
how did they choose, like, you know, especially right at the beginning there, like how did they determine which servicemen would come to your clinics or be a part of the program?
Yeah, we had a sign-up process, you know, and they screened them. And it was up to the doctors and the physical therapists as to, and we had special adaptive equipment too. I had a pair golfer and so they were able to, some of them, so this pair golfer was set up for people that had severe issues with their lower body. It might be an amputation. It might be paralysis, but it was a hydraulic chair. So it would lift you up out of the chair into a golf stance.
Right.
And, they weren't. And this guy, Anthony Netto, who, he's the one that helped design this pair golfer. Anyway, it was helpful. And there was adaptive devices we used, We had special gloves that went on their hand and wrapped around the club for guys that had problems with, you know, maybe got some sort of neurological deficit where their nerve in their hand wouldn't work. So
was this at the beginning about what year did SMGA start, or what year did you find it?
2007. It was started, but we started doing the clinics a little bit earlier than that. And then after I went through that one clinic series where we raised the money, of course, Tim was fine with it. The owner of the property, he thought it was great. And I got my friend Jamie Winslow involved, and he's an executive with the Japanese trading company. And he was kind of like a lobbyist, and he had a lot of friends in his fraternity. And he really turned out to be a guy that was great for, because he could depend on those guys when we would do these annual events to raise money. You know, we ended up doing annual. We did an annual event every single year at Manor since 2007.
Sure.
And now we're doing them at Argyle.
I guess one of my questions is, like, nowadays in 2023, there's a lot of golf organizations for wounded veterans.
No, there is.
But I imagine that in the 80s and 90s, were there any? Were we the first ones?
You know, the thing is, the PGA of America kind of, I don't want to say stole my idea, but they really did when they did PGA Hope. And so they sort of looked at Dan Rooney, who was a helicopter gunner pilot and started Folds of Honor. He wasn't a helicopter. He flew missions, F-16 mission. But anyway, so they weren't as back when we were really thriving back in the, you know, 2013, 12, they didn't have PGA Hope, but they wanted to have it. And so I kind of tried to get them to get on board with us, but they didn't want to, because they thought our mission was too limited in scope, because we only took care of the post 9/11 guys that were combat wounded combat wounded. So they wanted to help them all. So that's why it's called Helping Our Patriots Everywhere.
Got it.
And so that kind of hurt us, because, well, we got sponsorship from Booz Allen, and we got sponsorship from U.S. Senior Golf Association. It really limited. And we got some grants too. But PGA Hope is, you know, the much bigger in scope. So it's kind of hurt us.
But the difference in that scope is that they're helping just any veterans at all, whereas yours is specifically ones that were injured in combat.
Yeah, right. And ours, we give clubs away. They don't do clubs. And that's an expense that's pretty hefty expense for us. But we've always done it that way. And, you know, I think that makes our program a little more unique in that sense, that they have something that, if they're really serious about the game, they're going to have some good equipment to utilize. And not to take anything away from PGA Hope, it was always our intention to do that, and we've stayed with it. And TaylorMade has always been we use Ping and TaylorMade as primary, you know, sponsors of the program. So, and they don't give it. I mean, it's not free. I mean, we have to pay, I think, 40% off cost.
How did you, I understand just from reading some, you know, bios on you that, you know, through that process of starting these clinics and having so much experience with all these different types of injuries and disabilities from combat, I mean, you've got to learn all sorts of different and new ways to teach the golf swing. I imagine, you know, if a guy who's an amputee or a guy who's a man or woman who's got some kind of other major impairment, how have you learned all that?
Yeah. Well, I started doing all sorts of training and testing on myself, you know, like with a Swiss ball, balancing on the ball and hitting, and trying to simulate the same situation that these guys are experiencing, helped me realize how I could teach them and what muscle groups, and being able to take care of their attributes that they have, being able to utilize them and then give them a program where they can score. So there's really like a scoring method. So I would tell them, look, I want you to get the ball within 100 yards of the green, and that's not going to be out of the realm of possibility, whether you're sitting or standing, to hit the ball 150 to 175 yards. And I would have them hit shots with, you know, different grip sizes, different shafts. But also I gave them different when they played, they had a different expectation, because they would think, okay, I'm supposed to go on a 400-yard hole and hit my 260-yard drive, and then have 140 left. And but we worked a lot on rotation. The things that most of the guys had were, they were strong in the core, and they were, because of the training that they'd had in being in combat, that was helpful. So they had the mobility, even if they didn't have an arm or a leg, they had the mobility to get the club back and generate some speed. And with the special gloves, if a guy had missing a digit or two, we'd wrap it around, and they were still, if they had mobility in the wrist joint, they could still generate some speed in the club head. So, but what I gave them was a scoring method. So I said, look, you're going to try to get inside 100 yards and get down in three. That's your scoring method. So that's, instead of thinking about, you know, how far you're hitting the ball, let's just hit that driver 175. If you are swinging at 85 miles an hour, and then get that ball within 100 or 50 yards of the green. So that's how they got shooting E9 to 90 pretty easily, because they could hit the ball. And a lot of them had hand-eye coordination, very good sure. hand-eye coordination. So, you know, to shoot a rifle and, you know, backpack 20 miles, you got to be in pretty good shape.
Yeah, no doubt.
So, yeah, it was – go ahead, yeah.
I was just saying, so how was – because I also – did I see the SMGA has expanded quite a bit over the years as far as other sections yeah. in other parts of the country?
Yeah, we have a guy, Jerry Shanahan, up in Boston. He's got – Rhode Island and Vermont, and he's done an unbelievable job. He's a retired financial guy, and I got in touch with him through a guy named Bob Burke, Bob Beach. And Bob was one of the initial guys that I worked with when I first started SMGA, and he was an expert in working with people with disabilities. And Jerry is... he's partnered with a lot of the golf pros up there to do events. And also Vermont, Rhode Island, and Boston, that area, there's so many military people up there. I mean, it's a military sure. area. And he's done an unbelievable job. And then we've got a spot at Chambers Bay.
Oh, really? Okay.
And we've got a spot in Oregon. And we've got a spot now in Georgia. So...
Was there any
and there, like, are PGA pros that are doing the golf clinics, you know?
Okay. Were there indicators, though, back, you know, even when you started doing these clinics, call it 15, 20 years ago, mm-hmm. that golf and veterans, there'd be this this much of a, you know, this golf being so popular amongst veterans? Because it really seems back to the point of not just PGA Hope, but like all these other different organizations now.
Well, you know, what's funny is Veterans Golf Association, which is huge, was started yeah. right because of me. Not because I started it, but the guy, Josh, who started Veterans Golf Association, was getting his master's, and he's a Green Beret. He got injured and went through my program. And he's like, you know, I think as part of my master's project, I want to start something like a golf league. And
oh, wow.
That's how he started Veterans
so
Golf
Association. The founder of the Veterans Golf Association originally was in your program through the SMGA.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, he was so avid as far as playing the game. And, you know, some guys are super competition is in their blood, a lot of
sure.
them.
Sure. What's your take on, you know, why that is? What is it about golf and veterans that, you know, have such a wide range of physical and sometimes emotional issues post, you know, post-combat that golf is so appealing?
Well, I think it's a game that requires so much concentration that your focus you can totally get engrossed and compartmentalize with golf. And I think that's the lure for these guys. And they like what they like is they like two things about it. They like to get together, and most of them will compete, and most of them will not compete against other guys but themselves. And like I said, I think being able to get out, enjoy each other's company, and be able to talk freely and openly, which isn't once that wasn't really the military mantra for so long, was, hey, I'm too, you know, I'm strong. I can deal with this on my own. That's all changed. And I think golf's been a spearhead for that.
Sure. Absolutely.
Because you can learn a lot about someone in 4 or 5 hours. If you take the time. And frankly, I mean, you shouldn't be thinking about golf all 5 hours. So there's lots of conversations that go. I took a group to Ireland in 2012 and 13, and they got to learn about, you know, the history of golf. And a lot of the guys, you know, didn't know a lot of where golf started and how it came about, and, you know, these links golf courses and so on. It was it's quite an experience for them to realize that, oh yeah, that ground there has been here since 1400. And it's like, what? Right, yeah. Right. Links ground right on the ocean. Hasn't changed.
So you mentioned that your big event through SMGA is was at Manor for a very long time. And you said now
it still is. Yeah, it still is. Okay. Yeah. We just expanded to Argyle because our offices are at Argyle, and
okay,
we wanted to do something for them. And so in September around Labor Day, we do another event. We just had another event at Argyle, and it's a smaller event, a little smaller, but it's still really important.
Are these the type of shame on me, I haven't participated in one yet, but are these kind of events where, you know, someone can donate or buy a foursome or one and get to play with veterans that type of thing?
We have a vet for every group, you know.
Okay.
So that's part of the process. That's part of the learning, and it's part of the graduation process. And then of course the events that we have throughout the country that we can send our vets to are we partner with other organizations, Semper Vi Fund, Operation Second Chance, or JB Ball's group, trying to think of the name of it. Can't think of it right now. But guys are getting they're getting so much experience and traveling, like Reunion Resort. They're gonna go down, and when we have a board meeting, we allocate certain amount of dollars, and we allocate, you know, here's who's available. And a lot of times we'll take a group of guys from a certain area rather than have them travel. So if it's a tournament in Florida, we have a group of guys in Florida that fit the bill.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I certainly encourage anybody to check it out. SMGA.org is your website, right? Where you can learn about the events for next year.
And you can sign up for you can either donate or you can sign up for an event. Or you can just come to a golf clinic. We do them in the spring and the fall. We're always looking for people to donate their time and come out to one of the clinics. There's plenty to do.
Oh yeah. Anyone can come out and kind of volunteer and there's a role for them. Okay.
Yeah, there is. I mean, we have balls that need to be picked up because, you know, you've got 25 guys out there and we've got pros and, that, you know, they're very knowledgeable in disabilities, and I've trained a lot of them. So, it's worked out really well. And, you know, the key is we want them to enjoy the game. So I always tell these guys, look, your goal, you set the expectations for guys, you can break 100, you know, and that's something. And there are guys that are really good athletes that, you know, don't have a series of injuries that can do much better. But once you set the expectation, you give them a plan, like a scoring method, you know, and I give them a scorecard and it outlines exactly what there's 10 keys to scoring, you know, and I give them the 10 keys to scoring. And when they see the 10 keys to scoring, they're like, oh, okay, I can do that, you know. And you know, I always tell them one of the keys to scoring is not having such a bad start. And if you don't warm up, then you're going to have a problem. And I give them stats on how many, you know, from 6 to 8 feet, you know, what should you make? How many you should make if you're trying to break 100, you know, or if you're in a situation where you're a person that can't hit it more than 150 yards, well, how am I going to make a par? Well, you're going to have to get really good with your short game, but that's something you can do. And I give them right. a plan. So I give them the clubs. I give them 3 clubs to use. I teach them how to hit it the right, the same trajectory with each club, and try to get them to understand that minimum air time, maximum ground time is a better way to do it. And a lot of them are able to get inside of 20 yards. They're able to get down in 2, and we track it. We track it on the course, and we track it in practice. So, I mean, hitting the ball is one thing, but scoring, you know, you can learn how to score. That's something sure. everybody can learn. But nobody wants to learn it because they want to hit the ball.
I still struggle with that myself.
Yeah.
So what about, say, we talked about Only Golf Park. You were at Only Golf Park for about 20 years and recently transitioned over to you're working at Blue Mash now, right? How long have you been at Blue Mash?
I've been there since March of 2022. It was just, I love Blue Mash. The course is great. And Kemper Sports has bought the golf course from Joe Hills. So it's in good shape, and it's a good practice area. I can use the golf course and take people out on the golf course, so that's good.
That's good.
But, you know.
Is that making a move like that after 20 years when I imagine you've got a client base at one place, in your case, Only Golf Park, and moving to a place that, you know, maybe a further drive for clients, you know, maybe you lose some clients because they want to make that move. Like, is that?
It's been a little bit of a challenge. Yeah. It's been a little bit of a challenge for sure. And, the indoor component, you know, being able to hit, you know, under a covered area, that's helpful. I don't have that at Blue Mash, but I've got Peak Golf Fitness. You've talked to Jason. I can go sure. over there. You know, I would like to get a little more access to the golf course. That's all. That's because it's a busy place. I like to take people out and play with them when I do a lesson. And I'm able to do that to some degree, but not to the level that I would want. You know, Ollie's a good spot, and you know, they're still doing the golf clinics. I'm doing some over there at Blue Mash, but I want to expand that as well. I want to get more guys over there at Blue Mash doing the golf clinics.
On your website, jimestisgolf.com, you've got right there in big bold letters, take 10 shots off your score in 12 weeks.
Right.
What's the basis behind that? I'll let you call it a promise. I'm not going to call it a promise.
Well, so I would say what I do with people is exactly there's a recipe. You know, you've got to get. So I take the person's first. We do a golf assessment. You know, we do a game assessment. And what I've taught people is, if you want to take 10 shots off your score, you got to do 3 things. And I give them a book. I have a book. I'll show it to you here. So there's a mental component. There's a practice component. They have to do the scoring. They have to do the practice. So they have a journal, and they have to go through. And so the first time I go out with them, when I do a playing lesson, I go through the 10 keys to scoring, which is, you know, when you're in the rough, are you taking the right club? And then are you taking a look at where your misses are? And I can go through the whole thing. But basically all I've really done, and I do there's swing analysis involved. And we do quite a bit of swing change through motion training and doing things in front of a mirror and using some of the feedback stuff. I use training aids, if you will. We can get the person to hit the ball and play. And that's the key. And what I've done with people is I give them a 40 yard wide grid, and I tell them okay, we're going to work on your golf swing, but then you're going to have a performance-based practice where you're going to take the golf clubs that you use for 9 holes. And I want you to take my practice card, and I want to do an evaluation. You know, you got 14 tee shots. I want to know can you keep the ball in a 40-yard wide area? And most of them said 40 yards. That seems too wide. And I'm like, no, that's about what the golf courses around here allocate for being in play. That's about the amount. So they get a scoring method, and we spend a lot of time on 100 yards and in. We spend a lot of time on 20 yards and in. And, you know, if you're shooting 80, taking 10 shots off your score, that's not going to happen. Most of the people I teach are people shooting 100 that are trying to look to take 10 shots off their score. And even guys shooting 90, I can take 10 off their score because we got to get to 6 greens in regulation. That means you got 12 holes. You got to get, you know, no double bogeys. I teach them how to not to three putt. Now you're going to three putt some, but like if you could get your putting, you know, work on lag putting. There's some stuff I use. I've got this thing called Capto, and I've got this other thing called Blast. And what it does is it teaches you the timing of your putting stroke. So it gives you the amount of time it takes for your stroke, and the timing doesn't change. The length of the stroke is going to change, but the timing doesn't change. And so once they learn to use some sort of timing device, it helps them with distance control. And so if they do the work, actually, in the book, we have a practice improvement plan, and they have to sign the plan. They have to sign up and say, okay, I'm going to do this. And if they sign up and they don't achieve their goal, then I'll teach them until they do. And I've had a few, but not many.
Well, I don't think there's many teaching pros in the Washington, D.C. area that have actual PGA Tour experience, that have played in 5 majors. So, you know, your credentials are probably a step above most.
Yeah, it's helpful to have playing experience, but it's helpful to know the mindset for playing too. And so how to change your heart rate. But the thing that separates like a lot of these folks is some of them are good athletes and can hit the ball long ways, but they don't really manage their golf game properly. So that's why what separates my program, when I go out with people, I can sort of show them how to play, and I'll take a 5-iron and a wedge and a putter, and I'll go out there and shoot 40. They'll go, oh, okay, well, your 5-iron is only going 190 yards. And I'm going, right, 190 equals what? 380. How long's the hole? 420. Okay, I got a 40-yard pitch. I hit it up there 15 feet or less. I got a good chance at a par. If I hit a really good pitch, I'm going to have an 8, 6, or 8 footer. If you can keep the ball in play, you can play the game of golf. And so most people say to me, well, I'm making triples and doubles and quads, you know? And so I'm saying to them, okay, well, if you hit 3 bad shots in a row, how did that happen? Like I had a junior the other day, he's a really good junior. He can shoot 70, but he shot 95 and he hit 4 balls out of bounds. And I said, look, he's like, well, I want to just drive the green. Cause I want, you know, that's what a tour pro would do. I'm like, you could hit a 7-iron and a wedge and make a birdie, and you took a driver and you hit it out. But then what was worse is you took a driver again and did the same thing 2 more times. You know, so I always tell people that's a management problem. Yeah, you could take 1 bad swing, that's fine. But pick a club that you know you can get it in play. And I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but it's a management.
That's what works. That's why you need a coach. A lot
Everybody
of times it's a
yeah.
Speaking of coaching, and this will be probably our last topic here, but we mentioned it before we kind of started recording, but you had you coached at Good Counsel here locally for how many years?
Let's see, 2012 through 22, so 10 years. I really enjoyed it. It was fun. I just it was so much to do. We had so many matches. They expanded the conference, and it was just a lot of time. At the end of the day. But I think that to some degree that helped my coaching too, because I got to see firsthand how kids take on stress, you know, and how they handle, you know, and some of them put so much pressure on themselves. So my job was to give them not only give them some fundamentals and teach them how to play the game, but how to handle themselves, you know. So it was more like self-management, teaching them how to you know, control their emotions and talk to themselves in the right way. And we had, sure, we had good teams. I mean, Gonzaga and Prep were always a little bit better, but we were usually up there.
How much of a week? So you were giving lessons and doing your full time. You know,
yeah, we had
instruction at only golf park.
Yeah, I mean it was a lot because we had to practice twice or three times a week, and we had matches twice a week sometimes. So, you know, I would give them a practice program, and I had stations set up for them, and we had goals, and I had a practice card, and they had to make so many putts, and they had to chip it within a certain distance, and they had to track that proximity to the hole. And then they had to tell me, so I would work with them after school for, I don't know, they'd get there at 3:45 and I would work with them till 5:30. And, that was tough. I mean, because, you're talking about managing, you know, 10 kids and making sure they stay focused. And then, you know, telling them, okay, once I leave, I want you to do 14 tee shots, and I want you to measure what they're, not only how far they're going, but what is the miss like? Are you keeping the ball inside? And I had on the range big poles set up for, you know, like fairway markers, and they were 40 yards wide. And, so it was helpful for them to simulate. And, but I think that the program at Good Counsel, was good, for the kids, cause it taught them, you know, the most important thing was how to manage their life problems, not just their golf problems. And golf and life, there's a lot of similarities there. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
I did want to give you an opportunity to, you know, we spoke about it again before we started recording, but, one of your players and early students, Madison Smith, passed away recently. And I was curious if you could just share a little bit about, you know, what she was like as a student and a player.
Maddie had such a joy, an exuberance to her, and she was such a fun-loving girl. And she was a really good student, and she liked to have fun. And she would crack jokes, and she would laugh about – she made golf fun for herself. And that's the reason I think that she was able to improve. She listened a lot to the stuff I taught her. And I'm glad you brought that up, because she had a joy for life, period. I mean, she made – the reason she succeeded in golf was her attitude. She always had the glass was full, and she would ask me, like, you know, coach, you know, I would tell her, look, I want you to walk away and I want you to journal all the good stuff you did. She goes, oh, I don't have to do that. That's how I think, you know. So she was the kind of person that she could always turn a situation around if it was bad. And there wasn't too many, in her mind, there wasn't too many things that were bad. And I think that's what kept her going. She hit a nice little draw. I got her to work on the practice card and get to the point where I told her the goal, you know, she had to break 40 to play, and she did. I mean, she got to the point where she could hit the ball pretty far, but the thing that made her exceptional was her attitude, for sure. And she was a person that listened and respected what I had to say to her. I hadn't been in the circles, in Good Counsel circle for a while. But yeah, Madison, I had her from like fifth grade on, but she was really an exceptional young lady. She had a great spirit.
Well, I appreciate you sharing some thoughts on what she was like as a person and a player, and may she rest in peace. And well, listen, I know you've got a schedule of folks to coach and a schedule, I'm sure, of clients coming into Blue Mash. But congratulations, and I hate to end it on that somber note there, but congratulations on all your work with the Salute Military Golf Association. I'm going to make a point to try to make it out to at least one of the events or maybe a clinic in yeah. the new year. I know I've spoken with Chris Johnson, who's your executive director.
Yeah.
I know he's doing a lot of great work with SMGA.
Yeah. Chris is doing great things, and he's passionate, and he's got good connections. So,
yeah. Former radio guy. I'm sure he knows all. You know, he's well connected in the DC sports scene for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Well, if you ever need any help with your swing, let me. I'll help you out.
Absolutely. And any listeners, jimestisgolf.com and smga.org are the websites.
Right.
All right, Jim, we'll leave it at that. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast, and great to meet you and learn your story a little bit more.
Thanks, Alex. Appreciate you.
Okay.
I don't have a good golf game, but I don't really care. I'm a regular dude living in D.C., and I want to know about D.C.-centric golf stuff. You can tell me something that I don't already know, then that is great for me. I don't want the regular stuff. I want exciting stuff. I want different stuff. I want stuff I can't hear elsewhere. But I want it to be about DC golf.